Hey, we're all just home from the holidays, and there's been a lot that's gone on in our lives. Jack and I think, had experiences that were good and that were bad and that we learned a lot from. And I'm sure that's true of all our listeners, that, or most of them, that there's something that happened in the holidays that you have questions about. So that's what we decided to approach today. How do we deal with our families? How do we deal with people that are difficult for us?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Hey, this is shortly after the holiday season, Jack, and we've just gone through a lot of celebrations with our families and lots of people that we know have. And I'm going to kind of surprise you with the topic today and talk about what a lot of people now call the holidays. They call them dysfunction fest. And they call them dysfunction fest because so many people go back to family during the holiday season, and they end up having a difficult time. So I'm going to surprise you, and how about if we talk about how to deal with difficult family situations? What's our responsibility there?
Wow, okay. I hope I have something to say.
You do?
So what do we want to know exactly?
You know, Jack, I think I even said the dysfunction fest wrong. It's defunct fest. So let's go with defunctifest. And what that means basically is we go back to situations that are very difficult for us. As adults, we go back to our families. And we're grown up and no longer in that family system, and yet the family system seems to be carrying on the way it always has. So I guess the general question is, what do we as adults in our family of origins, what kind of responsibility do we have? Should we confront these situations? When should we confront? Should we be quiet? When should we be quiet? Should we wait to talk? When should we wait? What about if a parent is very old, or even we all know that they are dying? Should we react differently to them when we know that people may still have a number of years to live?
Mm-hmm. Well, those are excellent questions. I don't know.
Do you not know the answer to any of those?
I don't know the answer to any of them.
I think we can talk about these.
In principle, I don't think it's any different if it's our family than it is if it's a stranger. I don't know that we, in fact, in a lot of ways, as family members, we will have less of an entree into making a constructive contribution to their sanctification than somebody else might.
With our families, we might have less impact than with non-family members.
Right, because we're less invited in to make that kind of contribution. For example, it takes a very rare parent to be able and willing to learn something from their child that would revolutionize their whole life. I mean, that would kind of call into question the whole foundation of their entire life up to that point. For my child to come back and say, you know, it's been all wrong. A stranger might be able to do that if I'm in the right state of mind and I'm really open to the fact that my life is not working and I really need to know what's up here. I'm confused. I need to know what's up here. A stranger, somebody else I might listen to. it would take an incredible amount of humility for me to have my child be the one who's making that contribution. And some people have that kind of humility, and in which case, you know, they will make themselves open to that, and we will know that they are open, and they will give us the opportunity, and then we can speak into that opportunity. But a lot of parents will just be very closed and uninterested in what I have to say if I'm their child. I don't know if this is right or wrong, but it seems to me that our responsibility, what love requires of us, is that we be sensitive to and open to the opportunities that exist to speak. I don't think we have any obligation to make people hear if they are not interested in hearing.
I would say also, Jack, that we have the responsibility to listen to when we should not speak.
Right, right. Discern that there's not an openness, and out of love for them, not try to pry people open that are not open.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's entirely disrespectful.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes our urge to speak doesn't come out of our love and commitment for them, though we might see it that way. I think we need to look twice, especially with our family, and wonder if it comes out of some need from within me rather than their need.
For example, my discomfort with the fact that I may have a family member that I have some loyalty to and some attachment to and maybe some real fondness and affection and love for, who I'm not certain that their eternal destiny looks very good. And that's not, you know, that hurts, that's painful, that's very, very uncomfortable emotionally. And so am I addressing what's best for them, or am I wanting them to fix my emotional discomfort by becoming a believer and settling that issue for me?
Exactly, and I think you said it well, Jack, that many times when we want to confront people, I think it has to do, or pry people open, as you said, to kind of make them understand something out of our own emotional discomfort, rather than out of really looking at what is best for them, or what is possible, or what is right. Another example would be an adult child who really wants their parents to, or family member, to understand them, to perhaps even understand their faith. Perhaps their parent is not a believer, and they just want to be understood. They've given up hoping that their parents may be believers someday, but just, will you just understand my worldview? Will you just understand that I'm a conservative rather than a liberal? Will you understand that I really love being an engineer and I don't understand my parents as artists? Please, artist parents, understand me as an engineer. And I try and pry them open to get that understanding out of my own emotional need, and maybe even can be very hurtful to get them to come over to understand that, to try and push them, rather than to live with the loss of having parents that really don't understand me, that can't walk beside me because of their lack of understanding. And I don't want to suffer that. So I'd rather kind of pry them open, or I'd rather criticize them for not being understanding, or people that should do what I want. Well, the reality is, I think it's, as a child of adult parents, it's my responsibility to live with my own emotional discomfort much of the time.
And that's what actually faith dictates?
That's what faith
is. Is what you're saying?
I believe so.
Yeah. So that I'm accepting from the hand of God the fact that in my life, the realities of my life as God himself has defined that, is I'm being deprived of a kind of relationship with a parent where they really understand me and support me and affirm the direction of my life.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Jack, if I can't do that with my parents, well, I think, let me say this differently, I think that it's the hardest sometimes with our parents to live with that deprivation. Because of anybody in the whole world, there's just something intuitive that drives us to want our parents to come alongside us and to know us and to care about us. And it just sinks deeply into our souls when we don't have the needs filled by them that I think God kind of gave us need for parents in our hearts. I really deeply believe that's something
that's built in.
built in, hardwired into us. And when we don't get it, it's far more difficult to accept than if many other people won't give that to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why being home with our families, these defunctifests are so difficult, because we have such a need that's given to us by God. Very often it's not filled, and it really just hurts. And it's easier to be angry at them, to be critical of them, to force them, to demand them to fill my need, rather than to live with, and even, I think, faith would require, embrace the reality of my loss and my sorrow.
And would you agree that this actually makes it harder, if this is right, would you agree that it's actually unjust for a parent to not grant that to their child? It's like right is on my side. When they deprive that of me, they're really wrong to do that.
Right, and I can have that argument. They're wrong, I'm right.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I think it's wrong that they don't, but that's not the issue,
right?
You know. The issue is not to try and get them to do what's right, but for me to do what's right. And what's right for me to do is to accept what is given to me, whether I like it or not.
But it's all
and to not say, and no big deal. I'm not saying it's no big deal, but in accepting the sorrow, I really mean living with that loss. It might be might bring me to tears. It might bring some real deep issues up from, you know, the whole of my life of not having gotten what I wanted or needed. It might be incredibly hard and incredibly sad for me. And at the same time, and people say to me, well, okay, so what do? To sit on my couch and cry? And I'd say, well, yeah.
For a start,
for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that you might cycle back into that same sorrow your whole life. And then people say, well, that's just selfish. And I say, no, I think it's softening. And I think it's time well spent to have appropriate grief. And the beautiful thing about grief, if I really enter into it, is it lifts over time. If I'm accurately seeing what I'm grieving, I am grieving at the depth of my soul, like for a person that maybe has died. Over time, that grief lessens. Not because I've said it's no big deal, but because I've said this is a big deal and it does matter to me. And it just takes time to get through it.
Yeah, I think the issue, I mean, it's interesting that people would say to you, that's selfish. That's where the issue of justice is really very important. I mean, it would be selfish if I'm disappointed in something that I really have no right to, and it's really just my own agenda, my own self-centered desires that I'm disappointed in, then that's true. That would just be selfish. But if in fact what I'm being deprived of is something that is a profoundly human need that God has built into me, something that a parent ought to give their children, and if a parent is not giving that to their children, then what I'm grieving is not just me not getting what I want and need, but I'm grieving an injustice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grieving something that all the angels of heaven would grieve with me, presumably,
mm-hmm.
because it's something that's an aberration in God's universe. It's something that ought not to be. And it helps to see it that way, to recognize, no, this is not just selfish. I'm seeing something that is objectively wrong, objectively broken here.
And objectively is wired into me to hurt,
mm-hmm.
If I don't get it.
Right.
And it would be selfish to demand it.
Right.
That's where the selfishness would come in.
Exactly.
To be hurtful to the other person just so that I don't have to face into my own sorrow, my own loss, my own unfulfilled need.
That's the essence of my ongoing everyday walk of faith, is to be able to say to God constantly, God, this thing that you have hardwired into me to want, it's up to you to determine whether I will get it or not. Lord, I'm trusting you. Selfishness steps in and says, I was supposed to have it, and I want it, and give it to me now. I mean, let's run the universe my way. I want what I need. And if God is saying, I'm not going to give you what I created you to need, that's his business. And faith is able to say, that's your business, God. And maybe you'll never give it to me, and so be it.
Yeah, I said that to somebody today. What if you never get this? And I think that's a question we need to mm-hmm. ask ourselves, not just, okay, I'll hold my breath until my parents finally come around. But I think we need to face into our parents or whatever need, or if a person isn't fulfilling the needs that are justifiably there to be met, to say to ourselves, well, what if God never fills these needs? I think we need to be ready and working at the long haul that it is okay, it is God's prerogative to decide to deprive us and to maybe grow us up through the deprivation in our lives. That's a tough one, Jack.
Yeah. It's what the Bible would call a trial. It's something that's testing our faith. How seriously do we take God? How willing are we to let Him be the author of our existence, my Lord, my Master, who dictates what I will and will not have in life and so on? It's up to Him. And that really tests the essence of our faith, is whether we're going to let Him play that role in my life or whether we're going to demand that He let me dictate to Him how He's going to run my life.
So let me bring up a verse that a lot of people might be thinking about in these circumstances. I believe it's in Philippians, and it goes something like, I think I'm as bad at paraphrasing the Bible as you are. I could even be worse, Jack, but forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead. Let's look ahead. Let's not look backwards. And I think people would say, well, you know, what you're doing and looking at what your parents aren't giving you is really looking backwards. And you need to forget about that and just, you know, reach on, go forward.
Okay, you're catching me off guard here, but it's in Philippians 3, I think is the passage you're talking about. Not that I have already obtained it or have already become perfect, but I press on so that I may lay hold of that for which I was laid hold of by Christ Jesus. Is that the passage?
Keep going.
Brethren, I do not regard myself as having laid hold of it yet, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal of the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Let us therefore, as many as are perfect, have this attitude. And if in anything you have a different attitude, God will reveal that also to you. However, let us keep living by that same standard to which we have attained.
Okay. It is that very brief spot where let's forget what's behind and reach forward to what's ahead. Let's not look at the problems of the past, but let's keep going forward. Is that what that passage is saying, Jack?
And when they say, and this interpretation that you're asking about is saying forgetting what lies behind means don't have any thought to the past at all? Is that what they're suggesting?
I don't know if they'd be quite that thorough, but let's look ahead. Let's not look at the problems of the past. Let's not look at the difficulties of relationships that are behind you. Let's just look positively toward what can happen in the future. Now, I do think there's a lot to say about looking positively to what happens in the future. I have a significant problem with not looking behind, because it's almost saying God goofed. If I have to erase a large part or a piece of my past, then I'm saying that God isn't sovereign, that God didn't author my life, that He goofed, and I better not look at that because, oops, that's a little messed up, so I better not incorporate that as a part of my life and learn from it. I better just look ahead, and I hope God doesn't goof then. So I think it really questions the sovereignty of God, as well as it keeps me from learning from the things that have happened in my life. It's like wiping out all of history and saying it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go to this passage because I don't think the passage says wipe out what happened in the past. That's not the context.
Yeah, it would just be unthinkable that Paul would be saying that. I have to confess that I'm not sure what it does mean. I think there's probably several different options here, but without having, you know, really studied this passage, I'd be hesitant to declare what it does mean because I don't think I know.
I did take you off guard today, didn't
yeah.
I?
But it's unthinkable that it would mean what these people are suggesting that it means, because there's so many ways in which Paul evidences that he's not forgetting his past life. He's not forgetting the fact that the evidence is there that he's a sinner in need of the cross of Christ to forgive him. He's not forgetting the fact that he has some things in his life to answer for at the judgment seat of Christ. I mean, there's all kinds of things that he's not forgetting that have to do with the past. Clearly, the Bible suggests that we look back to look at what in the Old Testament are called the memorial stones. Is that what they're called? The memorials of God's faithfulness, of God's love, of God's demonstrating his presence to faithfully keep his promises to people. Well, that's looking back to the past. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence that that's a profitable and fruitful thing to do in many, many different respects. That can't possibly be what Paul is saying. If I were guessing at this point, just off the top of my head, I would guess that what he means by forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God. What he seems to be saying is, I remain diligent to pursue what is worthy of being pursued. So in what sense would you be forgetting what lies behind? I don't ever rest on my laurels. I don't ever complacently and smugly assume that I have arrived, that I have done all I need to do, that I can kind of coast into the kingdom of God without any diligence, without any concern about, is my faith authentic? Is my commitment real?
I need to keep running the race.
I need to keep running the battle. Exactly. Yeah.
I need to not say, hey, it's all taken care of back there. Now I can forget it and eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow I die.
Yeah, and I could die secure because I've already settled the issue of my relationship with God. If I were betting at this point, that's what I would bet on here. I mean, look at the context earlier in this chapter, just like about half a dozen verses earlier. He's saying, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the false circumcision. For we are the true circumcision who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus and put no confidence in the flesh. Although I myself might have confidence even in the flesh, if anyone else has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more, circumcised the eighth day of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. But whatever things were gained to me, these things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them but rubbish, so that I may gain Christ, and may be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of my faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death, in order that I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. And then we have the verse we're talking about, that I have already obtained it.
Jack, what I'm hearing from that, and I think what I've understood from that verse, is what was lying behind for him, what was in the past, was he thought his righteousness was based on following the law.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
He's finding out that, no, that's not it. I need to forget about that. I was wrong there. Now the whole basis for my salvation is completely and entirely different.
Exactly. Yeah, that seems to be the context.
It isn't talking about my personal history that I need to forget or an incident in life. It's talking about I had this incorrect worldview. I had this incorrect belief about what God wants. I was wrong. I need to set that aside and go forward and not stop going forward.
Right. Never allow myself to go back to relying upon those other credentials that I thought qualified me for God's blessing, mm-hmm. because I've come to see that they didn't qualify. They never did qualify me for God's blessing. So I need to forget all that, mm-hmm. and press on according to what's right and true in the way God is going to deal with us, namely the power of Jesus' resurrection, the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death, and so on. I get to where I want to go, being blessed by God, by this incredible humility, not by looking to past credentials that I thought would commend myself to God.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he means by forgetting what lies behind.
Mm-hmm. But I think if we zip those two little sentences out of the context, we could make it fit any situation we want. And I think that's so dangerous. I mean, I know you believe that is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And I live with that all the time in my work, with people saying, I can't do that. I can't look back. And yet it is so immensely valuable for people to incorporate all of our history and understand ourselves based on what's happened in our lives.
Well, and understand God. I mean, we can't even understand God if we don't look at how he's interacted with me in my history. It's, and knowing God is it. I mean,
that's
what this is all about.
Okay, we were going back to how do we respond to families. And kind of got a side trail, of course. But how do we respond to our families as adult children? And, you know, some other kind of situations are on my mind. And can I go with those?
Okay, sure.
Yeah. One is that I'm thinking is, you know, Jack, you and I have gotten to the place where we have adult children. We're not just adult children going home to our parents, but we have adult children coming home to us.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have been so reminded of is something that you said. I could be a parent that stiffens up and is unwilling to learn humbly from my own children. And that's so wrong. As you said, I think it's not only right for my parents to give that to me, whether or not they do, it's very right for me to apply that standard to myself and to be in a place to learn from my own children. So I'm not just talking about them anymore, but I'm having to really sit in it myself and say, well, do you believe what you've been talking about, Christine?
Well, do we really have to do that?
I saw this little smile coming on your face.
I'm not sure I'm ready to do that.
Yes, Jack, you do.
Okay. Yeah, no, that is true. But as you're talking, when I actually ask, am I really prepared to do that? That is tough.
The audience, you should have seen Jack. He had this little big smile coming on his face, and he put both his hands through his hair and roughed it up. So, I wonder what all that means.
Well, Amy, we have a long history of taking care of our children, of training them, of teaching them, of instilling our values in them. And so all the momentum of our life is going one direction.
All the momentum.
Yeah.
That's a really good way to say it.
And so to all of a sudden come to a screeching halt and go the other direction because they're seeing something that we're not seeing or seeing more clearly something, boy, I mean, the degree of courage and humility that takes is really amazing. And I, as you were talking, I was wondering, do you have what it takes to put yourself in that position, Jack? And I don't know. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. It hasn't yet occurred?
Well, not in any dramatic way. I mean, well, not in any way that I might be blind to the ways in which they're trying to get through to me, but I'm sure there's some more dramatic moments ahead.
Yeah, perhaps they're listening to this and saying,
yeah.
Oh, man, Dad,
yeah.
You haven't heard anything I've said.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe this is just giving them an opportunity to come forward. Hide the tape, Jack. Hide the tape. No, I think that it's really wise I'll speak for myself, for me to look at what has been difficult for me with my parents and apply that to my own parenting. I have found it even difficult, and this is in common with many parents, of course, to stop parenting. To recognize that when I have a son that's 19 and just moved out, and I just have to kind of keep it through my head that, you know, I used to be in a place to have input in his life in very significant ways. Even simple things like, guests are coming over, please clean your room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I'm paying for your dentist bill, I noticed your toothbrush has been dry for 6 months. How about brushing your teeth? Or, you know, I don't think I said something like that. I hope not to my 19-year-old before he left. But, you know, there was just so much input that we have. And at this point, I think it's absolutely wrong for me to have very much input at all in his life, except to say very little in order to communicate to him, it's up to you. I'm here if you want me to be, but I have confidence that you're going to think these things through. And if you don't, I have confidence God's going to train you through whatever decisions you make. And my job in that respect is done. and all the momentum, it's like this train was going downhill. Granted, over the years of them being teenagers, it slowed down, but still, doesn't it come to a crashing halt? I mean, I think I ran into a wall and I'm all bloody, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I do. Yeah.
As much as I tried to back off more and more, it's just all of a sudden done.
And I suspect, you know, talking about hardwiring, I suspect it's even harder for mothers than fathers just because of those strong maternal instincts that have been driving you for years and years and years. Yeah. And
well, you know, Jack, I'm 46, and I was talking to my dad the other day, and we were kind of talking about a financial thing, and he's good at that, and I still call him and ask him things because I'm really not good at it. And, you know, I ask him to speak into my life in that way. I invite it. But he went a little bit too far. He said, "Now, Christine, what you need to do is call this person, and this is what you need to say." And he started telling me the words say. And all that I've usually just
like
kind of...
when you were 14.
Well, or 10, you know, 10, yeah. To 8. And, you know, there's been many times where I just let him say it and then steamed afterwards. And this time I said, "You know, Dad, I think I got the words. I'll be okay there. I can talk really well." But it's... I am bugged by it, but I also understand that even though we're many, many years beyond me being his little child that needs input in that way, he still has that momentum. And I think that's something that I need to learn is, you know, shut up, Christine. Mm-hmm. You're a mom in a very different way with adult children.
Maybe we should change our linguistic habits, and that would help us all. Here's the woman that used to be my mother, and here's the man that used to be my father. Maybe that would help us.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. So anyway, I do think that we need to be speaking to ourselves. How are we going to be with our children as they grow up and give them the freedom to be adults, give them the freedom to perhaps speak into our life and be in a position where we're humble enough to hear it?
And I suspect that what we would find is that to the extent that we do that, more and more our children will invite us in to our advice, just like you are inviting the financial advice of your father. I mean, it's not like our children don't realize we have something to offer them in terms of experience and wisdom and so on, but we get in the way of being able to offer that to them because we come on so strong in our parental role.
Intrusively.
Yeah, we're intrusive, exactly. So if we would just back off, probably we would find them inviting us in a lot more.
Though the back off might take years and years.
Yeah.
And that's hard to wait. It's hard to wait. You know, but I work with a lot of adult men in my counseling practice, and what I hear from men even 50 and older is things like, you know, "I wish I had parents that had nurtured me," for example. You know, "I wish I had a mom I could just go and talk to." This is an adult, you know, 50-year-old man who's got a elderly parent, and they wish for a mom still. And that's just kind of that's what we were talking about, this hardwired need to have parents that really love us and that are nurturing us and take care of us. And so I really think we need to open up that opportunity for our children, whatever age, to receive appropriate nurture from us. And a lot of times what that means is just the kind of things we've been talking about.
So in that situation with those men that you're talking about, what are they not getting? I mean, what are they getting from their mothers instead?
Perhaps they always had selfish parents who were maybe just interested in themselves in some way, their career, their money, their position in society, more interested in taking care of their own needs in some way than looking at their children's needs or seeing who they were.
So they're not really interested in their children enough to just sit and listen and be a...
And care.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe have never been. Or were maybe to a very small extent, and this adult child who's perhaps successful in the world, and you would never consider that I've worked with white-collar workers for the last 25 years of my career, and this is what I've heard over and over and over again. These are people who are making it in life really well. They might be really committed to understanding and knowing God. They might also be socially very adept. You know, they aren't people who you look at as, you know, bleeding losers. They're people who you look at as people you might even like to see your own children be mentored by, and they have, I think, to their credit, an openness to their needs that they haven't hardened over. And there's a softness about them that recognizes, you know, I do have this vulnerable need inside of me that never got met, and that's sad for me. And if that brings them then to say, you know, how do I be a better parent, or how do I be a better grandparent, how much the better.
Mm-hmm. That self-centeredness gets in the way everywhere, doesn't it? The thing that keeps me from being there for other people is that I'm just so consumed with myself that I can't be a person for others. And we were made to be a person for others. That's how God made this to work. And we just sabotage it all by this self-centeredness that I guess is the essence of our sinfulness.
I'm really with you there. I think it is. You seem very reflective, almost as though you're thinking about yourself.
Yeah, and my whole experience. I mean, just everywhere I turn, seeing situation after situation, relationship after relationship, that it's somebody's self-centeredness that is destroying the relationship, perverting the relationship. And if we could just solve that problem, we would have gone a long way towards solving the problem of human existence itself.
Well, you know, in church on Sunday, I think we heard the essence of this. We were learning about Abraham, and when he went into the new country, I can't remember, was it Cana?
Yeah.
That he said to Sarah, hey, look, if you say that you're my wife, then they're going to kill me. So you just say you're my sister, and then we'll be okay. Well, it was his own selfishness. Of course, he wanted to preserve his life. But it was okay for him to send Sarah off, basically to have to be in a dangerous situation herself, or a humiliating situation, or a sexual situation with somebody else that wasn't her husband. He was willing to say, it's okay, basically, Sarah, for you to be hurt, but just save me, okay? I'll just use you to save my skin. And I just, when I was hearing that, I thought, gosh, isn't that so true? First, I got real mad at Abraham, like, oh, how could you do such a thing? And it's like, oh, wait a minute, Christine, how often have I sacrificed somebody else in order to selfishly meet my own needs? And I just thought that was such a picture of what we do over and over again. How do I save my own self is the guiding force of way too much of our lives, my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually I have a different take on that, but your point is so well taken.
You mean I didn't understand the passage well?
Well, no, I think you, well, I think
oh, don't I, have pop my bubble.
I have a different take on Abraham's motivation there.
But regardless of our difference in understanding his motivation,
your basic point is sound, I think. I mean, just that we do what you just described is true, is what we do all the time, is that we sacrifice other people for our own convenience, comfort, life, safety, whatever. And that's true.
So off the air, maybe sometime I'll ask you what you think Abraham's motivation is, but I think it might, would it take us off course here?
Yeah, it might, yeah.
Okay, so let's just all understand that I probably don't understand Abraham's motivation well and just really messed up that passage.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that he was the jerk that he sounds like he's being, because we bring that into our own culture. But I think if we were in that time and place and situation, I think we would perhaps see it differently. I mean, if we have the time, we can talk about that if you want. That's the way I used to take it. And I just, you know, it just sounded like such a completely selfish creep. But, you know, picture, think of those movies where you're in the wild, wild west, or you're in the middle of the desert where there really is no rule of law. We're not talking about an orderly society. And Abraham is going into the wild, wild west of his day, where you meet people who are as likely as to kill you as not. I mean, it's not like people are civilized. They're going to get what they want, however they want to get it, and do whatever they want to do. So I think what he's doing is he's envisioning going out here where these bandits, like these pirates, they may come across these pirates who will surround them, and they're going to size up the situation and decide what is in our What can we get out of this situation? What is in our best interests? And so what Abraham is doing is he's advising Sarah, we have a situation here where if you and I are husband and wife, they're likely to kill us both and take all of our property. I mean, that's the logical, the most likely, most plausible scenario, is they'll just kill us and they'll take all of our herds and slaves and everything and just keep them for themselves. So I don't think it's a matter of sacrificing Sarah for the sake of Abraham. It's, you know, both of our lives are at stake here. They could kill us both. On the other hand, if you're my sister, you're valuable to them because you're a potential wife now to the harem of whoever were the lord that we're under, our master, in Pharaoh in the case of Egypt and Abimelech in the case of wherever that was. You're valuable to them, and if you're valuable to them, I'm no threat to them. So we'll probably both be better off if we get in that situation, if you just pass as my sister and not as my wife. So I think what Abraham is doing is just appraising realistically the moral situation that they're in and is suggesting a prudent course of action. Is what he did wrong? I think it's kind of akin to the kind of scenario the SS officer knocks on your door and asks during World War II and asks you if you're hiding Jews. Is it wrong to lie in that situation? I don't think so. You know, I think basically translate what they're asking you. I'm in the business of killing Jews. Will you cooperate with me here? You know, my answer to that is no, I won't. I won't be a participant in your patently immoral activity. No, mm-hmm. I will not cooperate with you here. In effect, what these brigands are coming along and saying, we rob, rape, and pillage. Are you going to, well, no, it's not exactly the moral equivalent of that, but it's not exactly the same, but will you cooperate with our robbing, raping, and pillaging, or will you not cooperate with that? And it's like Abraham is saying, no, I'm not going to cooperate with that. We've got our other business to do. We've got to obey our God, and you do what you must do, but no, I'm not going to cooperate with you here. I'm going to let you think one way, because if not, I'm putting my wife at jeopardy and myself at jeopardy, and I don't want to do that. And that's okay. I mean, it's to not cooperate with evil is not to, we already have a morally broken situation. And when you have something that is as radically morally broken as pirates going around doing as they please, being utterly and completely lawless, it's very difficult to do the right thing in a situation that it's already profoundly wrong. I'll just leave it at that. And so I think Abraham was just doing the best he could with a very morally chaotic situation that existed.
So what I'd like to do with what you just said is consider it. And okay. I think, I'm not sure I'm convinced, but I sure do like being challenged to think in another direction. And I think what we're hearing here more than anything else is when we look at the scripture, let's look at it carefully. Let's not impose necessarily our culture onto it or our first understanding, but let's look more deeply. And maybe we're going to come to an understanding that we wouldn't, that's more accurate with that more thorough look. And that's the same that we did with the Philippians 3 passage. Let's look at the context of that passage. We weren't looking at the culture as much as the context. But those are two really important things to keep in mind when we're studying the Bible,
right.
Both the culture and the context. And I guess another one that I know of is really the intent of the author, not placing my glasses onto it, but trying to figure out what his are. So we didn't start this as a Bible study, but I think it was a great way to look at the Bible through the conversation we're having about how do we deal with our families as adult children. Mm-hmm. And I think we were saying, and how do we deal with our children as adults coming back into our home? So it goes both ways. What do I do looking forward, and what do I do looking behind at the children that are adults now? And I think what we're saying generally is we need to learn to be wise. Wise about when to speak to people and wise when not to. And there's no real easy rules here. It's not black and white. It isn't, gosh, you just do it this way and it's always going to work. What we have to do is be people who are really changing, Jack, from the inside out, and who are humbled by the lessons that God brings into our life. So we're not just techniquing relationships with people, but we're actually entering into them from a heart, from a mind, from a person who is really significantly changed from within.
Yeah, and since we know that about ourselves, we will interact with our parents and with our adult children in the same way, recognizing that the only one who can give them eyes to see ultimately is God. I'm not going to make it happen by getting in their face and going, see,
mm-hmm.
and try to manipulate them into seeing.
Darn it, see. Kind of more angry like that all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We get impatient because mm-hmm. they're not seeing what I see. Well, of course they're not seeing what I see if their eyes have not been opened by God. And so if God is going to use me to help open their eyes, then I take the opportunity that presents itself. But otherwise, I wait patiently for God to act.
Maybe,
because
God is going to use me to help them see by speaking to them. And
yes.
maybe, and more profoundly, God is going to use me to speak into their lives by not speaking.
Exactly. Yeah, my silence can show a kind of respect that may speak much louder than my words. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, we're not talking about taking my ball and going home and being mad at you because you wouldn't talk to me. That's not the kind of silence we're talking about.
No.
It's a silence that's out of humility. It's a silence that's out of a willingness to suffer with the deprivation of not having and not knowing if I'll ever have what I deeply and justifiably need, and living with that with grace and with mercy toward other people.
I was just having a conversation with a family member this past week who is not a believer, who's very hostile to the faith. And yeah, I had a whole week with this person and didn't really say anything. Just looking for any opening that might exist, but I wasn't trying to create any opening. He knows who I am. He knows what I stand for. And I believe that if he wanted any kind of information about what I believe from me, that he is fully capable of asking. Only one occasion arose where he asked me a question, and I answered the question, and in the process of answering that question, I said, you have to understand that I believe there's a huge distinction between Christianity and church. They're not the same thing. And made a brief explanation of what I thought the difference was. And at the end of that, he said, you're a real paradox to me. And that was the end of the conversation. But, you know, it was very clear that, you know, everything I stood for and the very few things that I have said to him over the course of a lifetime have just really kind of been striking to him. They don't really fit his picture of what it means to be a Christian. And I thought that was pretty interesting that he understood enough to know that this was paradoxical.
And a lot of that was not from what you said.
No, it's what I
from
didn't
a lot
say.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And he appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it moved into the kind of questions that he's asking that he may otherwise never have asked.
I hope so. I hope so.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
It has been really exciting, a really good thing for Jack and I to get together and dialogue about so many different issues with the backdrop of the Bible, trying to understand the Bible better, trying to understand how it fits into our lives in a real practical way. In addition to the radio, we've been trying to think about what are some other ways that we can dialogue with our listening audience and with other people to perhaps even expand the audience that wants to listen to what's being taught here at Christianity at Work. So we came up with the idea of offering seminars or workshops to people out there in your community. We would like to offer this for a weekend retreat, for a women's group, for your support group, for a men's group, a women's group, a home group, for your church, for schools, for colleges, just about any group that wants to get together and put together a workshop. We'd be really excited to help you out. The format that we're thinking about is an interactive one. Just as you hear on Christianity at Work, Jack and I are interacting with each other. The topic could be one of your choice. It is really wide open for us. What you want to have us present, we'd be very happy to do that. We also appreciate the dialogue between ourselves and our listening audience. We've had a couple of times where we've gone out to different communities, and that has just been a wonderful thing to get to know you, to see you, to interact with you personally, face-to-face. So your questions would be a big part of what we would do in any seminar. Depending on the response, we may not be able to meet everybody's needs, but we're going to try and do the best that we can. If you're interested in this, we invite you to contact Mackenzie Study Center. It's at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And the telephone number is 541-485-4801. And those addresses will be, and phone number will be repeated at the end of the program. We hope to hear from you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.